Hey, I'm Abigail Johnson, and you're listening to the Tennis in the UK podcast. You are indeed listening to the Tennis in the UK podcast. Welcome back. Today, we're rounding up last week's M25 event in Sunderland, where 20-year-old Harry Wendelken saw off all comers to win the biggest singles title of his career to date in his second final at that level this season. We're going to hear from Harry during this episode. It's an in-depth discussion where he gets quite brutally honest, so I would encourage you to stay for the duration of this one. But as we take a look back at last week's events, we have to start at the beginning. So, if you were here for last week's podcast, you'll know that we have just completed week two of a five-week stint of ITF World Tennis Tour events being staged in the UK. This is the fourth block of ITF events on British shores this year. We love to see it. This week, it gets increasingly interesting because there's both a men's event and a women's event in Glasgow. That's an M25 event for the men, so the second step up on the pro circuit, and a W60 for the women, so that's the third step up. Sunderland this last week was a men's only event, and as mentioned, it was a 25k level tournament, as was Sheffield the week prior. When you have a string of tournaments played in close quarters at a similar level, the draws for each one can end up being fairly similar, as players will look to avoid brutal turnarounds and compete as close to the previous tournament as possible. So there were a number of players in Sunderland that had been in Sheffield too. Having said that, the top seed was world number 352 Aidan McHugh from Scotland, and the number two seed was Poland's Filip Pilivo, who won the M25 event in Aldershot in August, and neither of those two had competed in Sheffield. Not only that, but neither of them survived round one in Sunderland. And that just underlines, once again, how fine the margins are in this sport, how little factors can make a big difference, and how fierce the competition is even at entry levels. In the opening round in Sunderland, Pilivo lost out to Johannes Munde, who had won the doubles title alongside Giles Hussey in Sheffield, and McHugh went down to French former college tennis player Lucas Poulin. Poulin deserves a particular shout-out this episode because he was also on the brink of taking out Sheffield champion Arthur Ferry in the quarterfinals. With high-level counterpunching, he won 10 of the first 11 games of the match, so he was 6-love, 4-1 up, before Ferry won the next 5 games to level things up and eventually edged out the win 7-5 in the third sets. It was another highly successful week for Arthur Ferry. Make no mistake, he is on the rise, and he is on the rise quickly. He won the doubles trophy this time around alongside Wimbledon boys singles champion Millie Polacek, and they took out the top seeds in the semi-finals, one of whom was Petros Tsitsipas, younger brother of Stefanos Tsitsipas, the current world number 5. But the biggest victory was in the final, where the duo defeated Hussey and Munde 6-3, 6-4. Hussey and Munde had beaten Ferry and Polacek in this Sheffield semis and were aiming to win 3 titles in as many weeks. So it was a lot of tennis for those guys, and it has been a lot of tennis for 20-year-old Arthur Ferry. He finished 3rd in week 6 of the UK Pro League prior to playing a whole week of singles and doubles in Sheffield, and I think the sheer volume of matches and the way they were starting to get quite lengthy as well finally caught up to him at the back end of the week in Sunderland. Number 4 seed Dan Cox wasn't quite patient enough to expose the fatigue in their 3-set semi-final, but Harry Wendelken was clutch and confident to get the job done 6-4, 6-4 in the final and win his first M25 singles title. Some week for Wendelken. I said it the week before last when the draw came out. He got the toughest draw in Sheffield. He lost in the first round to Polacek, who is still only 17 and is going places. as Wendelken himself looked to be earlier this season before a number of off-court factors and setbacks contributed to halting his progress. You'll hear more on that from him later on. But he overcame all hurdles in Sunderland, and there were a few of those. He came from a set down to defeat the number 8 seed Lucas Katerina in his first match. Then in the quarterfinals, he and Ben Jones battled for over 3 hours and hit 40 aces between them. And Wendelken had to save a match point there before closing out a 5-7, 7-6, 7-6 win. His 6-4, 6-4 defeat of number 3 seed Gonçalo Oliveira in the semis was comparatively comprehensive, but his win over Ferry by the same scoreline in the final disguises that things got a little bit sticky in that second set. Okay, the final then. I've already mentioned a bit of fatigue for Ferry, possibly mental as well as physical. He was missing 1-2 punches that he would have nailed a week or so ago, and he was doing so with some regularity. And that played a big part in Wendelken securing the only break of serve in the opening set and building a double break lead in the second set. But another factor in those misses from Ferry is how good a counterpuncher Wendelken is. He's a great watcher of the ball. He moves well. He turns defense into attack. And Ferry would have felt the pressure to do a bit more with those early balls, and maybe overthought them as well. The other things Wendelken did particularly well for much of that final, firstly, he hit back behind Ferry in some key moments, and that direction of shot is so important. And at this point, I'm going to apologize. I went running earlier, and I get this thing called runner's cough. I don't know if that's a thing or if I just made it up, and it's in my chest for the rest of the day, so apologies for that. But someone that doesn't have trouble running is Arthur Ferry. So speaking of movement, Ferry's pace around the court is a joke. And you want to avoid giving him a forehand on the run because of his options. Wendelken wrong-footed him in one or two pivotal moments by striking back behind. So that was a great plus in the match for Wendelken. But the big thing for him was the quality of the serve under scrutiny, and that was never more evident than in the closing moments of the match. So he went 5-1 up with the double break, and at that point it's impossible not to think about the finish line, particularly when it's your first title at this level that's on the line, and Ferry was the much looser player at that point. At one stage, he won a string of 13 straight points, and the tide was definitely turning. But from break point down at 5-4, Wendelken hit 3 unreturned serves and a volley winner to seal the title. And that underlined what had been so impressive about his week as a whole, clutch serving. Despite his first serve percentage being lower than he would have liked at the back end of the event, those second serves were catching lines and doing damage, and his intent with them was clear. So, it's time for you to hear from Harry. The discussion you're about to listen to covers a lot of ground. Harry was on the radar from his junior days. On an international level, he reached world number 34, and he talks about external and internal expectations and pressures and how those have affected him and continue to affect him. He also talks a bit about the current stars of the game that he has faced in the past, his own game right now, etc. He covers a lot. He's very frank with his feelings and opinions. I think you'll find it pretty insightful, and I'll hand you over to him now. Harry Wendelken loves a microphone. He had a nice little stint on commentary last month, so it seemed like a good option to get on the podcast. Are you pumped for this, Harry?
I'm very excited.
Highlight of your week, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That said, back in a final, we're chatting after the semi-finals when this airs. Final will have been and gone. But back in a final for the first time since the 25 in Shrewsbury in February.
Yep.
A lot has happened since then. Ups and downs, a few downs in terms of things that have happened off the court, illness, injuries. Do you just want to talk about kind of the year that has been since Shrewsbury?
Lot more downs and ups since Shrewsbury, because it was Shrewsbury, then Glasgow, I made semis, and then I went off to France a couple of weeks after that, and then I got pneumonia, and so I didn't play for, I think it was like 3.5-4 weeks, and then stupidly I decided to play the 4 weeks in outdoors at Nottingham when I did get advised not to play them and to still keep resting, but I obviously didn't listen when I should have. And then I went into that without any training, nothing. I feel like I was still recovering and still felt quite ill, and it kind of just set me back for the next 3-4 months or so. So then got the pneumonia about 6 weeks later, got the COVID again for the third time.
Third time,
yeah.
Wow.
And then after that, I started getting like a little bit like breathing problems and stuff like that. And then I should have gone to a doctor straight away, but I didn't. And then I went to the doctors and they found out I had a chest infection. So I probably had a chest infection for probably about, I'm going to say maybe 2 months. And then that's when I played the UK Pro League when I was on my antibiotics. But I went back to the doctors a couple of weeks ago and I'm all clear now, even though I don't feel 100%. But yeah, now I'm back to winning ways and feeling confident in my tennis. So yeah.
That's good. So, been through the wars. So you mentioned that stint in Nottingham, which I think was the second swing of ITF events in the UK this year.
Yeah.
You said you pushed through that. Was that because you felt like you were in good form and you just didn't want to let that go?
Yeah, I think a little bit. And I think having the opportunity of having four tournaments and me thinking that I could produce a level which could beat some of these guys, which was obviously deluded from me because I found out after the first week that wasn't possible. And yeah, I feel like I just wanted to play too much rather than listening to my body. As everyone always says, health comes first, because who knows what could have resulted. I'd probably become quite lucky that I maybe could have done more damage from playing and putting my body under that much stress. So obviously, touch wood, nothing else happens to me, but if it does, then I'll listen to my body more and the professionals to not play.
Retrospect is a wonderful thing. Okay, so there's been a lot of off-court struggles the past few months,
yeah.
But the results have started coming back again. You mentioned the UK Pro League. You won week 5 of that in September. You also picked up a doubles trophy abroad at 25K level last month. So in terms of, yes, the setbacks, in terms of physical stuff, illness, are starting to move to one side, but can you see anything different within your tennis that has helped to kind of produce these results again?
I think I've been a lot more professional in the things I've been doing recently. Obviously I could be better, but much better than I used to be. And like when I'm training now, instead of training 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, then 2 hours of fitness or whatever, me and my coach have kind of cut it down to just doing 2.5, maybe 3 hours, just like 100% in the morning, and then doing fitness in the afternoon, because the days get long. Like I feel like I'm not that person who can give 100% like for 4 or 5 hours a day.
Sure.
Whereas it's better to have shorter training, but if I'm giving my all rather than having longer hours but kind of going through the motions a little bit more. So I think that's helped me a lot. So yeah, I think that's probably one of the main things. Like I've been training leading up to last week. I had a tough draw last week, but leading up to that, I've been training like best I've ever trained in probably my whole tennis career, and just doing the little things better as well off the court. Obviously not perfect, but better. And it might be coincidence, it might be fluke or whatever, but obviously I feel like it's probably helped this week. So yeah. That's what I think is the main difference in my tennis.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in terms of that change to your schedule and your routine and how you do things, is that a joint effort, you and your coach? Who decides that?
I think he made the comment a few months ago, and we didn't really talk too much about it. And then we kind of had more of a talk about it, because obviously I trained with a few other players, Joe Garland and Yujiro. And we just sat down and spoke about it, like, how do you feel about this? Because in his mind as well, he was thinking, like, I'm paying him, so he felt like he has to be on court for longer to justify the payment and the hours and stuff like that, whereas it's probably not as beneficial. So we just all joint agreed that that'll be the way, see how it goes, and then kind of work my way up to potentially being able to train for 4.5 hours, like at 100%. And obviously I had been ill. I'm probably I'm going to say maybe like 80, 90% fully fit. So I was still coming, I'm still trying to get back up to 100%. So yeah, I mean, it's working at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It must be encouraging to see these kinds of results when you know that there is still more that can be done and that you're still actually not back to 100%. Yeah. So that's cool that that's been paying off. Let's go way back then. I say way back. You're still pretty young. 20,
yeah,
right?
20, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So 20 years old. But you were a very successful junior nationally, internationally as well. So I think you won two different age categories and singles at the Junior National Tennis Championships in the UK.
Yeah,
is that right?
I think I did. I think it was 14s and 16s.
Okay.
Was it 16? Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Right, and because around that time you made a run at Junior Wimbledon as well.
In the doubles.
In the doubles?
Semis, yeah.
So you had results early on. How did that affect your transition to the pros? Did you have lofty expectations for yourself? Do you feel like other people viewed you differently because of that?
Well, to be fair, my last year of juniors was like a really, really tough, like really, I think I started the year something like 30, 34,
okay.
And I actually dropped outside the top 100.
Right.
And then I went to 2 weeks in Israel at the end of the year, and I made two finals, so I got my ranking up again. But it was, I think it was, what year was that? 2019?
I can't really help you
there.
Yeah,
last year was 2019,
okay.
I think it was.
It was quite recent then.
Yeah, quite recent. And it was, 2019. And then that was a time when I went off to Sweden the year before that in 2018 from being at Coleford. I had a really, really good start, really liked it there. Me and my coach doing really well, had some really good success.
That was to train at an academy there in Sweden,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and then the LTA obviously started funding me. And I just felt like, obviously me being in Sweden, it was very tough for them to kind of see what I was doing and stuff like that. And I felt like, I wouldn't say it's their fault or anything, but I felt like they were trying to tell my coach a little bit how I'm supposed to be, in a way.
Okay.
Whereas I had Peter Karlsson, like he coached Robin Söderlind for a number of years. He coached some like really good Swedish players. So it's not like he doesn't know what he's doing. And I didn't think I was playing for myself. I thought I had an expectation to have to do well and justify getting funded. And then that brought in really bad nerves. And for maybe a year, 2 years, only recently, since I started working with Hamid, since I've been working with him, I've been able to deal with my nerves more and not get nervous on court. And even at the beginning of working with him, I was still getting nervous. It was only since probably the beginning of this year when I did well, where I wasn't getting as nervous. I think that set me back a bit. And then, as you said, going into seniors, it was the year of COVID. So I played...
Not ideal.
So I played... So they had that thing with you, the top 100. You got straight in to 15Ks. I played one 15K that year. But they only had it from when you turned 19. So obviously my birthday's late. So if it hadn't been COVID, it would have been good for me. But I used that junior ranking once.
Okay.
And then when I turned 19, I couldn't have it again. I was having to qualify, having to play ridiculously strong tournaments, whereas like the cutoff was like 400 in 15Ks during like the COVID time. So I was having to, I can't even remember if I qualified, maybe qualify for a couple of futures in that 2020 year, I think it was. Or 2021 year.
Okay, so last year.
So last year, I was struggling to qualify near the beginning of the year. Then I found more of a, found my game a bit more, been working with Hammond for a little bit longer then, and I was doing okay, made a few quarters. It'd been tough. Like, this is the first year where I felt properly confident in my tennis and my ability. I've always known it's to be there, but it's like, can I produce it on the court? And I think mentally, that's the biggest thing which has changed in my game. Because I always knew my tennis was there. It's just about how do I produce it? How do I put it onto a match court?
Sure.
And I feel like I'm doing that much better now.
That's great. So those external pressures were there, mm-hmm. and you did feel them.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you honestly feel that you're in a position now where that has no bearing on you?
No.
Or are you still moving away from that?
It's still in the back of my mind. It's like it's like a trauma in a way. Like, okay. I don't think it will ever go away, but it's always in the back of my head a little bit. But I just deal with it. And but the thing is, I feel like I'm playing for myself more now, me and my coach. I'm not having the LTA any funding. Like, I was kind of thinking about my parents because they spent a lot of money on me. Like, they sold their house to be able to get more money to keep my tennis. So I had that as well. So I was thinking, oh, if I'm not winning, then they've just sold the house. So they're spending these thousands and thousands a year on me. Like, I'm not winning. What am I doing? And then those thoughts creep into your head as well, with the pressure from being funded and all those things. I just couldn't take it. Like, that last year I played at Wimbledon, I hated it. I couldn't hold a racket. And I mean, if you ask anyone, would you hate playing at Wimbledon? They'd say, how can you hate playing at Wimbledon? And I hated it. I didn't want to be there. It was awful. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. And do you think, let's look ahead, so the next Wimbledon would be in around about 7 months' time.
Yeah.
With the kind of progress you're making in your career, the direction you're headed in, would you hope that if you were to get to Wimbledon next year, do you think it would feel different? So if you made it to qualifying or something?
Yeah, 100% it would feel different. 100%. And I think the biggest thing with the juniors is, looking back at it, I wish I did it so much differently. Because I'm thinking, why did I get nervous? Why did I care as much? Like, the grand scheme of things, it doesn't actually matter. Like, it doesn't matter if you're 5 in juniors or 45 or 105. Like, there's no money. There's no. Yeah, I just don't know why I felt in so much pressure and thought I had to win every match, rather than, as a lot of people say, like, trust the process. I don't think I did that when I was in juniors, especially my last year of juniors. So yeah, if I could go back at it, I'd definitely play my matches a hell of a lot differently.
That's really insightful. I'm going to come back to that kind of stresses and outside pressures thing again, but just while we're speaking about juniors, I know that you played against some interesting names around the kind of junior period.
Yeah.
Certain current world number one, mm-hmm. Carlos Alcaraz. Yeah. I think Jannik Sinner was in there as well. Can you, any other names off the top of your head that are doing well at the moment?
I beat Mazzetti in Canada.
Nice.
Unfortunately, I actually beat him with food poisoning. So then the next round, I had really bad fever against Gaston. Hugo Gaston. And then I think I was like 6-1, 3-love down. And I started getting dizzy. And then, yeah, I had to pull out. And I think that was in the quarters of Canada, the tournament leading up to the US. Any other players? Juniors.
It's interesting, though, because you were very much in the mix and competing with these guys. Do you remember vividly or at all what it was like to compete against the likes of Alcaraz and Sinner? Do you remember much about how they were playing at the time?
Sinner, when I played him, he just hit every ball as hard as he could. Every ball. It was probably like, wasn't going in much. It was either in or back fence. He was just creaming it completely. And I was thinking, what the hell is this guy doing? And a couple of years later, he's top 15 player. And I'm like, oh, that's what trusting the process is. And I wish I could have had that ability to go back in time and probably not hit the ball as hard as him, but play in a certain way with freedom and process. Because those guys, they always played their matches, not for the now, it's for the future. Alcaraz and Mazzetti and all those guys, now it's paid off, because not that they didn't care, but they listened and they trusted the process a lot more, and then that's why they've gone onto the men's scene much quicker than others.
When you see those guys that you were playing with now at the top of the game, A, is that surreal? And B, does that have any impact on you in terms of thinking about where you could get to yourself?
I think it used to, but not anymore, because I know, I can tell you now, I'm not going to be world number one. Like, that's just not going to happen. So I don't really look at it in too much. I don't think, oh, well, if I'd done this and this, or, oh, my level's the same as Alcaraz or Sinner, because, like, it's just, it. I mean, I'd love it to be. You never know. I can't say it won't happen, but I don't think I'm thinking more about myself and about what I can do rather than looking at them as much. Whereas I did used to always be like, oh, yeah, but if I'd done this and that, I'd be as good as Alcaraz, when probably not. Like, I've got to be realistic here. And I think if you think about that, it's it brings like more negative thoughts into your head, whereas the past is the past, you can't change it. So you've got to do what's right for you at your stage in your tennis, and that's what I feel like I'm doing more now.
That's a great outlook. You can't change the past, you can only change the future. So yeah, that is a really good point. Before we move on, I'm just registering something that you said there. You said I'm never going to be world number one.
Yeah.
So in terms of your goals, like internal expectations of yourself, if it's not world number one that is the target, how do you set goals? Do you just go season by season, or do you have that long-term view?
I know I have the ability now, my tennis wise, if I can keep this level up to, I don't know, maybe next year be, I don't know, 250, 200, I feel like I can get that. And then I feel like when you get to that level, it's kind of anything's possible. Like, there's an element of luck in it. There's an element of a lot of things. I feel like when you get to that sort of level, everyone's kind of very similar. It's just who can jump into that top 100. And the thing is, you get a lot of players saying, oh, I want to be top 100. I want to be top 100. But I don't just want to be top 100. I want to be like top 20, top 30, top 40. Because, you just get so many players be like, I want to be a top 100 tennis player.
You think that's quite vague?
Yeah, it's like, why do you not want to be top 50? If you're top 100, why can't you be top 50? If you're top 100, why can't you be top 25? Like, look at Dan Evans. He probably didn't go, I want to be a top 100 player. He was probably going, I want to be a top 10 player. So it's just having that different thought in your head.
I agree with you. So can I throw back at you? Mm-hmm. If you can be top 25, why can't you be top 5? And why can't you be top 1? There's no right or wrong answer. That's just your answer.
So I feel like when you get into like the top 5, it's just those guys are kind of already, those guys are already there. Like, they're not going anywhere. They're staying there for another 10 years. Like, Alcaraz might not win as many Grand Slams as the others have, but he's not going out of the top 5 anytime soon. I don't know. That's a tough question. I just feel like that level is just, it's like just crazy level. And yeah, and I feel like you've also got to, I've always liked to set goals which are potentially achievable, because if you don't make them and they're not realistic enough, you feel like you failed. Whereas my coach always says to me, whatever ranking you get to, whatever your best will be, if you know you've given 100%, then with everything you do, like diet, fitness, training, everything, then that's all you can give. So yeah, like my level now today is probably, I don't know, maybe 250, 200 in my opinion. Others might not think not, but, and then after that, it's what are you willing to sacrifice to get to that end goal? It's all about sacrificing. Are you going to sacrifice not going out on that Saturday or eating that instead of that? Well, I could be much better with that, but I'm kind of realizing that a little bit more.
Okay.
So yeah.
That's interesting. So last question, I won't press you too much further on this, but in terms of that top 5 realm, do you think that's more to do with life choices and sacrifice or talent, or is it a mix of both?
I think it's a mix of both. Because, I don't know. Yeah, I think it's a mix of both. None of those guys, you get the Nick Kyrgios and you get the Nick Kyrgios is 6'5". I'm not 6'5", am I? I can't just bring down 140 mile an hour serve. Like, that's just not going to be the way I play. But you get those, like some like Denis Shapovalov or Felix, like, you get those guys once in a while, but they're just the freaks of tennis. Whereas you can still get to that sort of level not being one of those freaks, but it's just a hell of a lot harder, so you've got to do way more than the other people. So yeah.
Okay. I will revert back to the here and now, because I know your coach is waiting for you as well, so I don't want to keep him too long. But just in terms of things that I've been observing with your game, and I've loved to see your progress over the course of the last year or so, and I know you've had your ups and downs this year, but all in all, a lot of positives as well, and you've said moving in the right direction. There is one thing I've learned about you this year, which is that you do like a chat on the microphone, which maybe I didn't know you well enough, I wouldn't have called that, but you like a bit of a chat on court as well.
I do say some interesting things.
You do. You have a little bit of a running commentary.
Yeah.
I think the commentary career is well lined up for you after you're done. But in terms of that, you mentioned outside pressures, not wanting to let people down. Do you in any way think that on court is a product of any of those things?
Yeah, because I feel like off the court, I'm not an angry person. I'm pretty laid back. Everyone would think I'd never get nervous, all these sort of things. People think I'm quite a upbeat and, like, what's the word? Positive's not the right word. Like, confident person. But actually, I'd rather sit in my room, watch YouTube, than go and spend loads of time with my mates and stuff like that. I just
okay.
And like interact with all the guys here at the tournaments. I'd rather not do that. Yeah, I don't know. And also, I feel like from my parents and my mum, whatever. Like, my mum's a great mum, as I said. She's not a very good tennis mum. And if she's listening, that's just I have to be honest here. And like, there's a lot of other little factors which makes me angry. Whereas, I feel like the tennis court is the only place I can let out my anger, because I don't want to show people that I'm an angry person. And then that, in the past, has affected me.
Okay.
Like, getting angry. And even still now, like, my emotions depend on how I'm playing. So if I'm playing badly, I'll lose my head. But if I'm playing really well, I'm perfectly fine. Like, I'll still say stuff to myself. But now I feel like I've found a kind of more of a level with my emotions, which I think is helping. Because I don't want to be too flat, because then I can't play with any energy. When I play well, I have a lot of energy. Whereas when I say a little bit of stuff to myself, when I get a little bit angry, it kind of keeps that fire in my belly. So a lot of people might think, oh yeah, I need to be really calm and this and that, but I just don't think that works for me. I feel like I need to have something to keep the spark. And yeah, that's just how I think.
That's intriguing. And it is subjective, right? It's different for every player and different personality types. Okay, let's move on and look ahead then. Mm-hmm. But actually look back as well, because as I say, by the time this goes out live, you will have played Arthur Ferry in the final this week.
Hopefully I would have won.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. He's in very good form. So that will be a very good win if you get that. We will see. Last time you made final of a 25K in singles, you went on to make the semi-finals the next week in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Next week, or this week when this airs, is a 25K event in Glasgow. Are you superstitious?
And girlfriend's with me as well again.
There we go. So it's all aligning. How, in terms of where your tennis is at right now, do you feel that the form you're riding is something that will extend beyond this week?
Yeah, I think so. Because obviously, touch wood, let's hope I don't get ill. Because I think if I hadn't have been ill, my form would have kept going. Obviously, everyone's form dips and stuff, but I don't think it would have taken a turn as it did at the beginning of the year.
Was there a period throughout the past 7 or 8 months that you can point to as the toughest period to come through in that regard? Any moment where it was particularly frustrating, or you were dwelling too much on the past as opposed to looking forwards?
Definitely Nottingham, those 4 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, those 4 weeks in Nottingham. Because then I went and played the challenges. I wasn't really expecting too much from myself. But yeah, definitely, because I had some tough losses in those 4 weeks. And then there was also the British Tour as well. I think I lost to Will Jansen. And at the time, I was getting so nervous that there was a time when near the end of the match, I was slicing forehands because I couldn't hit my forehand. Whereas it's not really what you want to have happen to you. But yeah, I can't really picture anything that was at the toughest. I just think there wasn't. I feel like all of it was tough. I couldn't pick a time where one bit was tougher than the other. But I just think all of them are similar.
It was just a run of months that you've now come through.
Just awful. Yeah.
And no nervous slices in the semi-finals here in Sunderland. No. A couple of slice winners, actually, that I remember. So that, again,
well,
steps
we are indoors,
in the right direction.
So I don't have to worry about the wind.
There we go. Yeah. There we go. So, okay, finally, moving forwards, what do you want to see from yourself on the court, aside from wins, in terms of attitude, things you want to put out there? What are your expectations for yourself?
Just fighting really hard. Just tennis matches, as my coach always says, is a long time. Like, you can win matches by not playing well. You don't have to play well to win matches. And I think that's what I've been doing well recently. I did a couple of weeks in Portugal. I think I made quarters. Every match was a third set. Like, I've been coming through a lot of these three-set matches, whereas when I was having the tough times this year, I wouldn't say bagging it, but just letting my emotions get to me and not hustling and trying to win the match. I was just dwelling on how I was playing rather than you can win a match playing badly. So yeah, that's what I feel now, that yeah, I can play badly and still win matches. So yeah.
Awesome. Essential quality to have. Harry, always a pleasure.
Thank
and appreciate
much.
Your honesty.
Yep.
And all the best for the next events. Well done
Thank
this
you.
Week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you once again to Harry for his time, and apologies to his coach, Hamid, for the time he had to wait on site for that interview to conclude. That's it from me this week. My attention now turns to the action in Scotstoun in Glasgow, where the likes of Katie Swan and Heather Watson, familiar names to some, are featuring in the women's draw. Come back soon to hear all about how that goes. In the meantime, I truly aimed not to be that beggar who asks people to like, subscribe, share, blah blah blah. It just makes me cringe, but I'm starting to realize it doesn't work like that. So if you're still here, I figure that you thought this was a decent podcast, and if you did, if you jump on social media and share those feelings with the world, then that is one less time that I have to shove it down everyone's throats all on my own. So if you could do that, if you enjoyed, that would be much appreciated. You can also follow Tennis in the UK on Instagram at tennis_in_the_UK, bit of a mouthful, and on Twitter at tennis_in_the_UK. And you can hear me again next week. I'll catch you then. Thanks for listening.